Welcome to the Mothball Prophecies. I am your host, Jonathan. On this episode, I'm going to be talking about a little-known close encounter of the third kind, according to the scale devised by Dr. J. Allen Hynek. This particular case took place in the Sierra Mountain Range in California during September of 1964. This is a very unique case that is unlike any I've come across from that time period. You see, up to 1964, encounters with extraterrestrials were mostly friendly or even humorous, if not menacing, involving gentle or awkward space brothers who looked like, no surprise, white people, or, quote, little green men who ultimately meant no harm. Already, I can hear UFO enthusiasts preparing their statements prefaced with, actually. And yes, the Kelly Hopkinsville incident, or invasion if you prefer, took place in 1955 and received national coverage for a very short period of time. But what about Betty and Barney Hill? They were abducted in 1961, and those beings looked nothing like humans. And you are correct. However, the Hill story didn't make the news until 1965, a full year after the incident we're discussing today, and even then, it only made the papers in Boston. Look at me, just knocking down those straw men. Regardless, the topic of today's episode is wholly unlike either the Kelly Hopkinsville goblins or the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill. This is not about friendly space brothers, little imps, or cold analytical beings on some mission to perform experiments. No, this is a tale of terror with multiple witnesses, one of whom, Mr. Donald Shrum, was hunted throughout the course of the night on September 4th, 1964. As with many encounters with extraterrestrials, I always try to picture how this would play out as a movie. In most cases, encounters of the third kind do not always follow a linear path, and thus don't translate well to the screen. Fire in the Sky was certainly a fun movie, but many liberties were taken with the information, and it had to be framed around a missing persons case. The UFO incident, the movie about Betty and Barney Hill, also took many liberties. And while it was a pretty good movie, it also had to be framed as a couple trying to recover missing memories. As you will see today, the case we're discussing would make for a linear movie, certainly, but it would not really hold the viewer's attention. Maybe as a found footage movie or some sort of variation on the sci-fi horror movie Hardware, but I think it's a better story to read or to listen to than to watch. So let's get into the encounter experienced by Donald Shrum. In 1964, Donald Shrum was 26, with a well-paying job as a welder for the Aerojet General Corporation located in Sacramento, California. Aerojet, for those interested, manufactured Minuteman missiles, as well as the Titan rocket engines, which were used for our own Gemini space program, as well as the Viking landers and the Twin Voyager probes. Additionally, Aerojet developed the Polaris surface-to-air missiles and anti-aircraft missiles. Needless to say, Aerojet General Corporation employees were not lacking for work, what with all of their government and military contracts. And if you fall into the camp that believes extraterrestrials pay attention to civilizations that gain mastery through leaps in technology, then the United States in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was the place to look. We had nascent quantum capabilities with our atomic weapons, a burgeoning space program, and TV dinners? Televised presidential assassinations? Whatever it was. It certainly resulted in much higher rates of UFO sightings than in other areas of the world. It was also the age of better living through chemicals in America, and Donald Shrum worked directly with a substance known as trichloroethylene, or TCE for short. In addition to being used in paint thinner and as an industrial cleaner for metal, TCE was also used as an analgesic in childbirth. In short, TCE is a highly unstable carcinogen that causes cancer, but is actually still in production and used to this day. As a result of exposure, Donald Shrum experienced a number of health issues in his later years. There are also a number of places in the southwestern United States where TCE has contaminated groundwater and has been linked to numerous types of cancer. However, I did not see anything that drew connections between trichloroethylene and bouts of paranoia or hallucinations, so we can rule that out of our analysis of Donald Shrum's experience. So, on September 4th, 1964, Donald Shrum decided to go on a hunting expedition with two of his co-workers, one Vincent Alvarez and the other Tim Trueblood. They decided to go hunting in the area of Cisco Grove in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Now, for those of you in the camp that believes extraterrestrials may be coming here to harvest precious metals to power their ships or extract orgone energy or what have you, this particular area of California was considered gold country, with large deposits all over the place. And if extraterrestrials were coming to observe wildlife, Cisco Grove was home to mountain lions, raccoons, bears, birds, fish, deer, and now three humans, who, unlike most animals in that area, had ties to our military-industrial complex. Anyway, on this particular hunting expedition, Donald Shrum decided to take his bow, as he used to say he had more luck with that than a gun. The three hunters set up camp near one of the small lakes in the area, a few miles south of Route 40, and waited until evening, when the animals would be out and about. The three hunters decided to start spreading out, with one person heading into the small canyon directly below, one person on one ridge on the side of the canyon, and Shrum on the other ridge. They were to meet up below and start hunting. Now, remember, this is 1964, so they didn't have walkie-talkies or any kind of long-distance communication devices. As Donald Shrum was walking along his ridge, he noticed that it came to a sheer drop-off, so he decided to walk down one side and around to where his co-workers were supposed to be. And as he was doing so, it was getting close to night, and he couldn't see too well, and he ended up stumbling and rolling down the ridge. Recovering, and realizing he was about a mile or so from where the camp was, and not wanting to encounter a bear at night, Shrum decided to make a perch in a nearby tree and wait until morning, when he could find his way back to his co-workers. This was about 7 p.m. A couple of hours later, Donald Shrum saw something very unusual. There was a light off in the distance, above the trees, but below the mountaintops, slowly moving from east to west, making a bobbing motion. At first, Donald thought it might be a lantern or a flashlight, but when he saw it go over a particularly tall tree, Shrum thought it might be a helicopter from the Forest Service, and that his hunting buddy sent one out for him after he got separated. Now, while this was happening, Alvarez and Trueblood met up and went back to camp to wait for Donald. As they were doing so, they saw a strange object moving through the night sky. Or at least Alvarez did. Trueblood didn't like talking about the whole incident. And this is where their statements kind of trail off. But back down in the canyon, Donald was still under the assumption that this light was coming from the forest ranger's helicopter. So he got down from his perch and started lighting a signal fire to get the attention of the pilot. But as the object drew closer, Donald Shrum noticed that it wasn't making any sound, and that the object had three brightly lit panels on the side. He then realized that the craft was huge, cigar-shaped, and apart from the panels on the side, had one very bright light on the front that lit up the trees and the ground. To pause briefly in the story, it sort of reminds me of the spacecraft at the beginning and the end of the movie Night of the Creeps, which I also need to watch again. I dearly miss local television channels that played whatever the hell they wanted to in the 1980s. But back to the story. Once Donald realized that this wasn't a helicopter or some small craft, he quickly climbed back up in the tree and remained as still as possible, because he got a feeling that the craft was observing him. The large ship circled around the tree and started to head away from Donald. At this point, he was able to take in the full size of the craft by the light of the moon, and how the ship was blocking out so many stars in the sky. Suddenly, one of the panels on the side of the ship opened, and a smaller vehicle came flying out and headed further down into the canyon, making no noise as it descended. Donald would later describe the smaller craft as a module or lander. The smaller craft was shaped like a dome and silver in appearance, with a small flashing light on top. It zoomed past Donald and eventually landed on top of a ridge. The next thing Donald Trum heard was the sound of something, or multiple somethings, crashing through the forest from the direction of the lander. Remember, the idea of a larger craft containing smaller ships is certainly a trope now, but in 1964 it really wasn't. The Apollo program had only been in existence for 3 years at this point, and the concept of a, quote, mothership was not on the tip of anyone's tongue. A few minutes after Donald heard the noises coming from the direction of the lander, he saw a short humanoid creature emerge from the woods. It was about 5 feet tall, stocky, wearing a one-piece uniform, and it had what looked like either a mask or a helmet on its head. On closer inspection, Donald saw that the creature had large, circular eyes that made it look like it was wearing either welding goggles, or they had just, you know, may have been the creature's eyes. Just large, black circles. But apart from that, Donald could not make out any facial features on the being. So, what we have here is definitely not a gray, not a little green man, certainly not one of the tall Nordic-looking space brothers. I'll be honest, my first impression when this creature was introduced was this is a space dwarf, not to be confused with a sex dwarf. Then again, I just got off reading Passport to Magonia and decided to pick up Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries by W.Y. Evans Wentz, which was published in 1911. Jacques Vallée makes a lot of references to that book in Passport to Magonia, and how the older folk tales from Europe line up very closely with extraterrestrial encounters from the 20th century, and Evans Wentz's book has a number of truly strange and wild stories of the Fae. I definitely recommend it, especially to any authors out there who are looking for either source material or inspiration to overcome a writing block. But let's get back to Donald Trum and the extraterrestrial. The creature came within 100 feet of the tree Donald was in, and just stopped to examine the plants on the ground. Then a second identical creature appeared. Donald was getting rather worried and was trying to formulate a plan, being literally up a tree and all. He decided to employ the tactics that had worked for him up to this point, namely, being as still as possible and hoping the beings did not notice him. But the creatures then moved to the base of the tree and stared right up at Donald. So apparently his plan, along with his hunter's camouflage, weren't working so well. Again, Donald saw their large black eyes, about as big around as silver dollars, an image that haunted him for the rest of his life. Now, abductees, experiencers, whatever name you give them, they always remember the eyes. They may not remember the limbs too well, but they certainly remember the eyes. Barney Hill went into a state of absolute fright when he remembered the eyes of his abductors when he was under hypnosis. Similarly, Donald Shrum would wake up in the middle of the night screaming, "Those eyes!" at the top of his lungs. And that was without hypnosis. He would have those recurring night terrors for 2 years straight immediately following the incident. The being stood still, not doing anything except making cooing and hooting noises like owls. Those weren't owls. It's never owls, despite what Joe Nickel might tell you. The beings then returned to examining the plant life. As the night went on, the two creatures were joined by others, and Donald Shrum's recollection is that there were as many as 6 beings wandering around, crashing through the forest and examining everything they saw. But then another being joined the party. This one was about the same size as the others, but it had eyes that glowed like fire and illuminated its face. The being was metallic, with a huge hinged jaw, and moved in a stilted manner. It avoided all of the underbrush and took the clearest path directly to the tree where Donald was observing everything. And this is where the terror really starts in the story. And we'll pick up right after these messages.
Hello! Dr. Pinkerton of the Consortium of Genius here, ensconced within my secret lab. At long last, the time has come to reveal my master plan. While you have all been preoccupied with that insipid but popular virus making the rounds, I have been readying my laboratory for a bold new test. The evaluation and elimination of my sonic competition for World Takeover! Yes, ladies and gentlemen, every week I shall be capturing a different band here in the secret lab and subjecting them to hideous, hard-rocking experimentation live! Friday night at 8 p.m. Be here to see what fate befalls the unwary. And find out if they can escape from the secret lab!
That's Escape from the Secret Lab every Friday night at 8 p.m. Central. Tune in to catch great live music, mad science, and a chance to win great prizes. That's Escape from the Secret Lab, the only live stream where you, the audience, determine the outcome. Now, back to the story. The metallic creature poked at the embers of the fire Donald made earlier when he thought the large craft was a helicopter coming to rescue him. Then the creature turned to the tree and just stood at the base. It opened its jaw and sprayed mist or some kind of gas from its mouth. Donald said the gas had no odor, but immediately he felt dizzy and passed out. Now, metallic creatures are certainly nothing new to ufologists. A year later, in 1965, a family in Florida would report seeing robotic creatures. Almost a decade later, Charles Hixson and Calvin Parker would report being unable to fight back against their robot-like abductors as they were carried into a craft in Pascagoula, Mississippi. For more about that, listen to the two-part series I did on the Pascagoula incident. But it's not like these people got the idea from Donald Shrum, because he didn't go public with his story for quite a few years. In Donald's case, we can't say if this was a robot or simply one of the other creatures in some sort of heavy gear. It's not like they were being friendly and inviting Donald to come take a closer look. But Donald woke up at what he now recalled as being an hour or so later, still tethered to his perch, and immediately threw himself into fight-or-flight mode. Since Donald Shrum could not exactly flee, he took out his bow and aimed at the creatures down below, not wanting to hit the first group of creatures because they had done him no harm whatsoever. And because he was certain they'd retaliate, Donald Shrum decided to aim his bow and arrow at the robot. He let loose an arrow, which struck the robot in the chest, causing a flash as an arc of light shot out. The other creatures scattered about a bit as the metallic one, or robot for lack of a better word, stumbled back against a rock. Donald fired twice more, hitting the robot again and again, causing more light to arc out from its body. Oddly, none of the creatures fired anything in return. Donald then took out a book of matches, set it on fire, and threw it down near the creatures. They really backed up at that, so he decided to set his hat on fire and threw that down. The creatures backed off to a distance of about 100 feet, again from the base of the tree. Emboldened by the reaction, Donald was now intent on starting a brush fire. Perhaps, and this is my own conjecture, losing sight of the fact that he was in a pine tree. Suddenly, a second robot appeared and stood next to the first at the base of the tree. Donald didn't know what to do. He dug into his pockets and just started throwing loose change down at the creatures, which seemed to distract the first group. Looking back, Donald Trum believed the coins might have been of interest because they had dates on them, and the creatures could glean all sorts of information from our currency. Or maybe they just liked shiny things. He even threw down his canteen, which the beings picked up, looked at, and then just dropped. When all else failed, Donald started howling like a coyote to try and make the extraterrestrials think he was signaling for more of his kind to come and join the fight against these creatures. This had no effect on anyone involved, whatsoever. The robots again sprayed their mist, though, and Donald once again passed out. This cycle repeated throughout the night. Donald would wake up, try to scare the creatures, and then they'd release mist and he'd pass out. This part of the story is why I simply can't see it working as a screenplay. Donald was getting hopeless and was now actually contemplating killing himself, flinging himself out of the tree to the ground instead of being trapped in this endless cycle with the extraterrestrials. The robots then stood together, facing each other, and light flashed between them, and a very thick cloud of mist rose up the tree from the robots, and Donald, once again, passed out. When he woke up, the sun was rising, and the creatures were gone. Soon after, Vincent Alvarez came down looking for Donald, found him, and they made their way back to camp, where Donald Trum recounted the event of the evening. Alvarez confided that he, too, had seen something strange in the night sky. Alvarez and Trueblood got Donald back to his wife, Judy, and he told her the entire story. Fearing medical issues such as radiation poisoning, Donald was checked out by a doctor. He desperately wanted to tell someone about his story, so he contacted the Air Force. This is a fairly typical reaction when someone sees something unusual that comes down from the sky that is clearly not of military or civilian origin. And this is where we get into the aftermath of the incident. Two men were dispatched from the Air Force to interview Donald Trum. He gave the two officials an annotated map of the area where he and his friends were hunting, told them the entire story, and he also gave them the tip of an arrowhead he collected from the ground that morning, one of the ones that struck the robot creature. He never saw those two items again, the map or the arrowhead tip. And the official report under Project Sign was that the incident was psychological in nature. And yeah, the two people from the Air Force reportedly were gaslighting him, telling him that he didn't really see anything. You know, maybe it was a meteor shower. Maybe it was owls. But Donald went back to the scene of the incident and found no evidence of the beings, but he did find a bunch of cigarettes, all from different brands or manufacturers, as if people had definitely come to investigate the area. Don and Judy met with people from APRO and NICAP, and in 1967, his story was retold by John Keel, who my listeners might know as the author of the Mothman Prophecies. Keel's retelling was, admittedly, inaccurate. either accidentally or on purpose, but it brought Donald Trump's story to a wider audience. In the mid-70s, Don underwent hypnotic regression to get more details about his encounter, and in 1978, the series Project UFO, produced by Jack Webb of Dragnet fame, put out an episode that was loosely based on Donald Trump's experience. This episode, in particular, was done without the Shrums' permission, but it did lend credence to the notion that Jack Webb was good friends with J. Allen Hynek and had access to his files. It should also be noted that all three hunters were fired from their jobs at Aerojet General Corporation, either because they talked too much about UFOs while they were at work, or because officials from the Air Force tipped off the bosses at Aerojet that they had some pretty strange employees. Remember, in the 1950s and 60s, the U.S. government saw UFO believers and UFO groups as vulnerable targets that could be swayed, infiltrated, and co-opted by communists. I'm not joking. And a business with a government contract certainly couldn't have three UFO believers working on the same rockets that were used in missiles and our space program. Side note, if you believe Bill Cooper, to counteract the potential Red Menace, the FBI and CIA ended up infiltrating and co-opting UFO groups. For more information on that, just go read Behold a Pale Horse or watch the documentary Mirage Men. So, that's the story of Donald Trump. And while I want to believe, something is sticking in my craw. I certainly believe that Donald Trump was the most interesting life form in that immediate area that night, and the creatures wanted to investigate the crazy biped that was throwing money and fire at them. But I also don't understand why the creatures didn't take down the tree. Barring that, maybe because the creatures operated on a do not disturb the immediate area policy, despite the fact that the appearance of the large ship was less than subtle, why didn't they take that smaller lander up to extract Donald? I'm utterly baffled by this. However, to take this in a slightly different direction, the beings came at night and disappeared with the coming of the dawn, which lines up with many tales about monsters and the Fae of Europe. There was no smell of sulfur, however, which I was fully expecting the second the tale mentioned the robots expelling gas, which would have tracked with encounters with other extraterrestrials, fairies, demons, and whatnot. Was this a purely psychological incident? If so, how does it account for the other hunter and what he saw at night? I'm not going to go into debunker mode, because this was an overnight hunting trip, so it's not like Donald Trump had anything to make up to cover for or, you know, hide other actions he was taking in the woods with his friends. And the truth is, we'll never know what the third guy, Tim Trueblood, thinks, because he refused to give a public statement and kind of disappeared from the face of the earth shortly after he lost his job. So we'll just chalk this up to a singular, terrifying event that had bad repercussions and traumatic events, which also tracks with many CE3s and CE4s. These experiences seem to ruin lives, or unlock a pattern of behavior and consequences that cause people to fall apart on social, emotional, and psychological levels. But I'm not a doctor, not even on the internet, so I can't speak to that in an official capacity. And that about does it for this episode. Remember to like and subscribe to the Mothball Prophecies. Join the Facebook page if you want to share your thoughts. And remember, the Halloween contest is still running. So if you want some special merchandise from the Mothball Prophecies, send your creepy stories to mothball@crescentcitymedia.com. Next week will be another casual episode, and then I'll be back with another tale of the unexplained. Until then, sleep tight.